You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now, a favourite of the show, Helen Houghton. Good morning, Helen. How are you?
Oh, good morning, Marie. It's always great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you back. Of course, Helen is the leader of the new Conservative Party and a law student. And Helen, I love you to pieces, my darling, but you did put my blood pressure up this week when you sent me this document, which is what we're going to discuss today. It has come out from the Law Commission. It is called A Review of the Protections in the Human Rights Act 1993 for people who are transgender, people with non-binary and people with innate variations of sex characteristics. You know, just rolls off the tongue, that title, Helen. It's a rather large, chewy document. I've scanned through it, and there were things in there that, honestly, if it weren't first thing in the morning, I'd be reaching for a glass of Chardonnay. What is this, Helen, and why now?
Okay, Marie, let's start at the beginning. So first of all, we're going to open a can of worms today. And in an hour, we will only skim the peak of this iceberg because its reach is expansive, sweeping across all sectors of our society. I thought that a lot of people may have known about this, but clearly a lot of people don't. And even those who have talked about it, it's important that many more voices are actually talking about this, because most people are only going to hear about this, you know, from the other side of mainstream media. Well, I'd like to set the scene for your audience to have these key things in mind before we delve into it.
Absolutely,
Is it the role of government to regulate or recognise gender identity? Should the government be involved in defining or validating personal identity, or should it take a more hands-off approach? So I'd like your audience to think about that as we go through this. I believe it will lead to an overreach of government power. We know how that looks, right? And if people think that this won't happen, I assure you that I have over a dozen law cases in front of me now that I have analysed from overseas who have embedded this gender identity in their Human Rights Act. So as you have it said, Marie, this is about the Law Commission are reviewing the Human Rights Act currently. And it's about whether the prohibited grounds of discrimination in sections 21 of the Human Rights Act should be amended. Now, I'm just going to go quickly to that section so that your audience knows, because not everybody reads statutes, right? I never did before my legal degree started. So section 21 lays out the prohibited grounds of discrimination. They are sex, marital status, religious belief, ethical belief, colour, race, ethnic or national origins, disability, age, political opinion, employment status, family status, and sexual orientation. So that covers quite a vast section of people or groups that cannot be discriminated against. And in my opinion, I think that is quite comprehensive and full. What this amendment is talking about is reviewing protections in the Act for people who are transgender, people who are non-binary, and people who have innate variations of sex characteristics, which we know as intersex. This paper, the issues paper that the Law Commission have put out, is number 53. Mm-hmm. It is open now for submissions, and it closes Thursday, 5th of September. So we don't have long here. Yet this, as you've said, your blood was boiling. I mean, I would suggest that your audience, when they look at this, that they take it in small chunks, because it is 200 pages. It's very comprehensive of so many areas. And today we'll only delve into some of it, I know.
So the acknowledgements for me was always a good place to start, knowing, having spoken to you and Dylandy and the like. And there were a few names in the acknowledgements that leapt out at me straight away, which then already told me that the direction that the document was going to head in. And they were Ahi Wehongi, Dr. Elizabeth Kerikeri, and to a lesser degree, Professor Claire Charters. And I'm thinking, oh, here we go.
Well, it's interesting that you mention those, because I've got that written down here that I wanted to break down some of those involved in the initial stages of this review. they thank these people in the beginning, that these are the key people involved in that, how this paper is being presented. So Dr. Elizabeth Kerikeri, for those who don't know, was a Green MP until she was outed for bad behaviour. And I can say that because there is a quote from the party leader, her party leader at the time, in regards to Kerikeri's actions, that she sent messages that appeared to fall short of their values as members, and it was part of a pattern of behaviour against staff and colleagues. A number of allegations surfaced about her conduct towards other MPs and members. Now, this is from the party leader about Dr. Elizabeth Kerikeri, who is being praised for her involvement putting together this document. Right, so that's one of the ones that you talked about. And then we have the Ahi Wehongi, sorry, I probably didn't pronounce that correctly, let alone pronouncing people's genders. And she was the first name on the expert advisory group on this paper. This Ahi is director, executive director of gender minorities. This Ahi goes as they, them, and Ahi's qualification is in population health. Yeah, I don't know about going on that track, but population health is a qualification which focuses on the social detriments of health. Now, Ahi was one of the groups who took an MP to court over allowing Posy Parker into New Zealand. So clearly, Ahi is all for free speech if it's his. Oh, sorry, I might have just misgendered him. Ahi, I have no idea of the gender that Ahi goes by. But look, these are some of the key figures that are pushing this through. Is this democracy, Marie? I mean, we've all been invited to submit our objections on this paper, but it's clearly been created with their input. And I've already found sections of it where it is badly constructed, presenting biases.
Illegal document. Yeah, even just as a skim. So you read out those characteristics before within the Human Rights Act that were already enshrined. And there were two that stood out, but the first main one was sex, okay, in terms of sex. Now, agreeing with this, I do not, is the legislation that got passed last year in order for people to change their sex on their birth certificates on a whimsy. So surely then, if you're able to do that on your birth certificate, depending on what you feel like that week, that month, that day, that year, surely then this entire document is moot because you're already protected by what's enshrined under sex. Why do they need to do this? Why do they need to go forth and create these protections, which theoretically they've already done by getting the birth certificate identification passed? Or am I just being too much common sense, Helen?
Way too much. Look, I'm actually appalled at the fact that there's professionals, supposedly professionals and intelligent people who are actually involved in piecing this together. I mean, it's a document, it's a law, this is a legal document. And common sense, I don't know, look, yeah, there's male and there's female. This whole debate around sex, gender, is, you know, like you just said, they have the protections there. And what we're doing now is, just to give you an example, one of the things that they said, I'll just find it, because this is how nonsensical it is, equating sex and gender, prioritising gender over sex. No, sorry, there's something really important that they say in here, which is along the lines of what you've just said. What I noted is, they say very early on, actually in page 12, it's very early on, a 200-page document. So you've got these proposals, yet they even admit to not going to tackle those differences or perspectives on sex and gender, which is, like you said, it's nonsense. It's nonsense because it underpins the whole picture of what we're talking about here in this document. Yet they're not going to actually. They say in 1.5, we do not seek to resolve non-legal questions, for example, the meaning of terms such as sex and gender. So I ask you, Marie, why are we conducting a review to add something to the human rights that cannot be explained, for one? I mean, it's the umbrella to all this nonsense, yet they are actually sidetracking their own argument. I'll give you another example where I'm going. The rule of law is a fundamental principle that law cannot be vague or difficult to define. It needs to be clear and unambiguous. people will not only have a limited knowledge of this gender stuff that we have been, you know, indoctrinated with, some of us have seen a lot more than others, but those who've got extreme views that are pushing this campaign, the everyday people out there, everyday individuals, won't know what's required of them or when they are actually committing an offence against gender-questioning individuals. I mean, this is not even about a protected group, though, because there's such a wide variety on the subjective identity, as we know, i.e. the spectrum. I mean, individuals are making new identities all the time. I just found a new one yesterday where they describe themselves as transmasculine, and then I had to look that up. Have you come across that one? That's a new one. But
is this Sam Smith's new thing?
Well, it's actually been adopted by someone here in New Zealand who's part of these groups.
It's utterly ridiculous. I mentioned on Media Matters the other week that I got phoned up for a political survey, and I haven't done one for a while. But I thought, let's live out on the political fringes as I do. Let's do the survey. So I did the survey, and right at the very end, the last question was, what is your gender? I said to him, well, darling, as far as I'm concerned, I know the answer to that. There are only two, but I want to know how many you've got on your form. And he was like, no comment. But it was ridiculous. It is crazy that there is no definition. As you said, the law needs to be clearly defined and easy to understand. Gender is this totally, I mean, it's even saying, you know, gender fluid. It's this completely boundary-free soup of shit that no one can understand, and it deliberately puts up triggers and landmines for people to trip over. And I think this is what stood out for me with this document is that the Human Rights Act already has so many protections in it. Mm. I would have thought with the birth certificate protection that would provide those protections to a person who is in the trans community, because if they're that committed to it, they would have changed their sex marker on their birth certificate, which I don't agree with, but that's already there. So therefore, why do you need to go here? And more than that, I'm wondering, is this purely, knowing the people who have gone and been involved in this, is this an ideological document? Because the hate speech laws were so heavily defanged that they're trying to get this entrenched elsewhere.
Yeah, 100%. All of the, you know, you talked about the different gender stuff. I mean, the subjective interpretations of that is going to lead to, you know, we'll stick with the law at the moment, the unpredictable outcomes and inconsistent application of law, okay, because of, you know, what they're pushing. But we already have a social divide, and this will create a widening gap and eroding public trust in the, you know, not just legal systems, but in all government institutions. And I want to talk further on about how this is going to affect employment. Mm. So it will. But incorporating this, all these overly complex terms into the law, it's going to lead to not only that legal uncertainty, but increased litigation, abuses of power, infringement on other rights, and challenges in enforcing it. I mean, even Laws 101 in my first year about the importance of maintaining the integrity of a legal system, it's essential, and we talked about that, these things that are drafted give clear, precise language that's easily understood by all people. This ensures that all citizens will be aware of their rights and obligations, and that it's fair across society. How many people will have no idea at all at work, for example, if they misgender somebody that they thought was a male, and now this is hate? This is, you know, I've got a lot of cases, like I said, in front of me where this is actually happening, this is occurring. You know, we've talked a lot about the education issues in the education sector, but now what we're seeing is this is impacting right across society. We see more and more frustration and a level of shock because that these compliance directives are leading, you know, and it is that whole, the hate speech stuff is, you know, it's just being dressed up as something different.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that was my sort of initial scan of it is like, okay, you've not succeeded in one area, so you're trying in another. So let's dive into the employment side of things, because that again was one of the first things that leapt out as to me, being somebody who has been self-employed for a long time, has worked as an employer. The Human Rights Act is already quite a powerful act anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of protections there, and they've become, having had a brush with them many years ago, my brush with them many years ago is quite, if I were to have that same brush now, I think it would be a completely different outcome. So in my particular case, I manage a retail store. I said to a customer, I needed to get past to get something for another customer. And I said to this woman, well, excuse me, sweet pea, can I just squeeze past you to get this for another customer? I got taken to the Human Rights Commission on a breach of ageism.
Sorry.
I used the term sweet pea, which I used as a term of endearment. Oh, and believe me, that is a process that I really do not want to repeat ever again. It was not a pleasant process. It was utterly farcical. We did actually get to the point that the person who laid the complaint was a serial complainer to many departments. So it was more about them than it was about me. And we went through the process and it was seen as that there was no complaint to be upheld. However, not a nice process. So therefore, what you then create as an environment, as an employer, you will self-censor yourself to a point where you will either let a employee run roughshod, because if you have to place boundaries to that employee, you may could be brought up on a breach of the rights, or you actually look at that person and you think to yourself quietly in a job interview, I mean, if it were me and a CV was coming in and they put their pronouns there as they, them, bin. File 13 for me straight away. So it's saloon door. It swings both ways. I do not understand, Helen, the final outcome for this. What are they trying to achieve? But if they do achieve it, what does it mean for people like me who is an employer?
Well, that is a massive, massive topic. And this is part of what I wanted to cover. Just starting to cover this today. We need to dissect it more. But please, your audience, go to chapters 8 through to 15. That's the really important one for your listeners and for you, Marie, as for all those people who are employers. It discusses, and this is part 2 of Human Rights Act, it imposes obligations on private individuals and organisations, which also will mean, you know, your workplaces. I have got some cases here which I'm just going to only touch on a little bit, but some of those areas that you've just mentioned in here. So if, for example, somebody comes with and they write down on their application, they are they, them, in this document, it's got a part on employment around how you are going to, how employers need to be dealing with this. So it's got chapter 9, employment, scope of protection. So they talk about that the people who are transgender or non-binary have difficulties in employment. They include difficulties finding a job, having personal information disclosed, receiving worse pay conditions, not being promoted, being removed from customer-facing roles, not being allowed to use a bathroom matching their gender, being harassed or bullied, being called the wrong name or gender, sometimes which is called dead naming or misgendering, and losing a job or feeling they had to quit. These cases in front of me talk about, you know, your concerns. And so I suggest, before I talk about any of them, is for people to go and have a look at this in the document, find the cases that I'm going to refer to shortly, and actually see how this is being dealt with in other courts in other countries. Because every case that I have looked at, the employer is liable for injury to the feelings of these people that you employ who are identifying as any other particular type of gender. There are some, actually, one key thing that comes through all of them is the court findings were that they were discriminated against and their feelings were impacted. Okay, note that word, feelings. This is actually what we're being, what you're going to be charged with if you don't play the game. Okay, so you will be required to do mandatory training. You will have third-party liability. So, for example, Sorry, I had to laugh when you said about the squeezing past somebody, because that's actually in one of the cases I've read where somebody laid a whole pile of complaints on his employer. And one of them was where they actually squeezed, had to, you know, in a small space, had to squeeze past them. And they tried to say that, you know, they kind of rubbed their genitals or whatever on this person. But, you know, that's just one tiny example where you squeeze past. And the name, you said sweet pea, that's another term. So there were terms such as that in one of these law cases where, you know, I mean, we all do that, don't we? In some areas where maybe it's from getting comfortable, but it's personal relationships that you have with your employees. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes you're working in situations where you've known people for years and it's like part of a family. So it does get comfortable. It's not always. Yeah. So there's a lot of things going on there, but these cases, they are being sued for pain and suffering and for feelings. Some of them, you know, you're going to end up having to pay things like $30,000 to this person who's left their job because their feelings were hurt because they were misgendered. What I might do is just read one or two really briefly so that... Give you an idea, yeah. I mean, I've gone through 15 cases, and you've got to understand these cases, some of them are up to 30, 40 pages long. So you have to, you know, go through them. And not everyone out there has read a law case. So I do suggest, you know, maybe just picking a couple that are relevant to the area that is important to you, like employment law, for example. We've got case summary, Nelson versus a restaurant group. Nelson was a non-binary gender fluid person who uses they, them pronouns. During the employment, they were repeatedly misgendered by the bar manager who used incorrect pronouns. The person complained to management, and management, like yourself, didn't deal with the matter, ignored it, basically. And after a while, they were dismissed from their job because that person got heated. But the claimant claims that the bar manager and the response of the manager also amounted to discrimination based on their gender identity. What happened there was the restaurant group was ordered to pay $30,000 in damages to Nelson for injury to their feelings. The restaurant group were also liable for the employee in their premises that actually misgendered them. They had to implement mandatory training of no less than 2 hours for all employees, including managers. And then they had to do periodic checks. There were some where I read that they actually also expected people to list them on a database, those who would refuse to do this kind of mandatory training. So this is just one example. I'll give you another one. Here we've got another employment one. C was a transgender man who used masculine pronouns. He was assigned another name at birth, which he hadn't been legally able to change. Now, he worked in a truck driving company. The complaint was that he apparently was harassed based on his gender identity or expression being repeatedly misgendered. And then the outcome was the court found that he was harassed in the workplace based on his gender identity. So you see, once we put this gender identity in our human rights, it opens a floodgates of, of all these court cases.
Okay, so call me cynical, Helen, looking at, again, some of those people that were acknowledged on page two. Mm-hmm. Is this not then setting up for an industrial grievance complex situation where you are creating an industry for these activists in retraining with all these cases that come through? I mean, there's got to be a financial benefit here. And I mean, isn't that what they're doing? They're creating, they codify this in law. They claim they're doing it to protect the rights of people that sit within this part of the community, which again, as I said before, if you're actually going to argue that, they should theoretically already have those rights there based on the changes in the birth certificate laws. But all they're doing is creating an industry for themselves of retraining and indoctrination to employees and any other individual that doesn't toe the line.
So right. The mind boggles to think about how employers are going to implement these training. And yeah, I mean, we've already had, what is it, rainbow training in some, I mean, this is part of it, isn't it? Clearly, it just wasn't out there. And, you know, it was kind of more overt. It was overt covert, you know, where this training has been talked about a lot, the rainbow tick, but this is even bigger now. And yeah, there's like these organizations are the experts who go into the schools and provide other experts, as in teachers, training around how to respond to all of this. And it is a money making, you know, there's a lot of, yeah, it's exactly what you've talked about. There's a lot of other concerns here that I've got. I said that there's a bias, but some of these views in here not only are legal, but they're impacting on human rights frameworks have always been traditionally built on the recognition of inherent biological differences, right, and the need to protect those individuals based on differences. If we alter this foundation of focusing on gender identity, we actually risk changing the nature of rights from what we've already done with protecting vulnerable classes to accommodating individual identity choices. You know, have those in decision-making really considered the far-reaching consequence of what this entails, which could undermine the universal or objectivity that human rights actually are intended to represent. The really concerning thing for me that I want to highlight is this is supposed to be a paper where it's an issues paper, right, where people are invited to submit to, but they have stated clearly in this that they have reached a preliminary conclusion that amendment is necessary. So while, you know, yes, we're opening this up for democracy so that everybody can input, they've stated in there that they believe this is their preliminary conclusion. It says it in there that it's necessary. So what's going to happen with all of those submissions? You know, they've already decided, haven't they?
But this is this just follows on, though, from so many other things. I mean, the Midwifery Council, the preliminary changes there in terms of the code of practice, it was a foregone conclusion. There was something, was it 97% of the submissions against that were negative and it went ahead anyway? To me, this is just a virtue signalling exercise where they're doing this because they know they need to do it. I think you could have everybody talking about this being having a negative impact and no one will do anything about it. And the difficulty for me with this is, unlike the hate speech laws where you had a campaign from the Free Speech Union and also to a lot of support given by VFF and this station to actually push back against a lot of those laws, this is why you've brought this to us now, is that this also is just as wide-reaching. All they've gone and done is it's whack-a-mole, you've whacked it over here. They've gone and popped up with the Law Commission. And those that normally would stand up and say, well, hold on a minute here, this is, you know, we're for workers' rights and for people's rights, but there are limits. Well, they're not going to do it because the trade unions are all on board with us. So because from a political and an ideological perspective, the Law Commission are showing their ideological leanings more and more often now, having spoken to lawyer friends in this space. They are getting more and more disturbed about what they're seeing. We know that the judiciary is becoming more captured, particularly around the areas of Tikanga and Te Tiriti. See, that was the area I dived into, was the entire chapter about how does Te Tiriti, the Treaty of Waitangi, affect this in terms of codifying this into the Human Rights Commission. And I was like, the first thing that was going off in my head was Di Landy's voice saying, there are no songs, no tukutuku panos, no kaupapa to the great trans warrior. It does not exist. The treaty theoretically is around citizenry, is around people, regardless. So why would the treaty have any impact whatsoever over this?
Yeah, Marie, thank you. Thank you for bringing that one up. That's one chapter I haven't touched yet because I've got enough to delve into. However, I am doing an interview as well with a Māori lady in a few weeks around you know, her views on this. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing from other Māori instead of just those few ones that we know that we've identified in the paper. Yeah, I mean, this is absolute bonkers. You know, I have to say bonkers, but there are a few other points if we can also look at. Let's look at women's rights for you know, I mean, there's been a lot in the news over, well, not really in the news, but on social media. There's a lot of discussion around women's rights and in sport, as we saw over the Olympics with the boxing. But, you know, I'll acknowledge that recognising and protecting people who are going through a season of a gender identity, whatever that it looks like, is important to them. Equating sex and gender, or prioritising gender, this gender identity, over biological sex will dilute the rights and protections of women, as well as other groups who we rely on sex-based rights. So, yeah, the approach, you know, it's going to erode those, in my opinion, erode those established protections. But it's also, like, not just a personal opinion, but it's going to, it's crucial for data collection, right? I mean, the legal ambiguities and the conflict between competing rights, potentially this will undermine the fairness, I mean, and the effectiveness of the legal system in protecting everybody. I'd like, you know, your audience to think about how in this law that we could balance the rights of, for example, what they're proposing with the transgender individuals with the rights of others, such as free speech and religious or cultural beliefs. What I'm seeing, and I said, created something recently where I said that it's gone from a man's world to a trans world, because everywhere you look, it's all around the protections of trans and these gender identities. We need a bit more of a debate around this. And yet the paper itself has said it won't go there. It won't even talk about to define what this sex and gender means. One thing they have in here, Marie, on page 25, reinforcement of a gender binary. It's funny how on one hand they're saying they won't go there, and then on another, they've got it in here. This is what they've got. The use of cisgender implicitly reinforces the idea of a gender binary by categorising people strictly as either cisgender or transgender. So what they're doing there is they're even, like the binary thing, they're making you either cisgender or transgender. So isn't that a binary? You know? I mean, look, one example which I will address in my submission, I mean, some of the cases that I've analysed, they claim discrimination where, like I said, they're asking people to stop them naming them with their birth pronoun or passport name, and the person hasn't stopped, so we're held liable. Well, then we can actually require the exact same treatment. So I am hugely irritated and offended when people call women cis or call me cis, and we're hearing that more and more, which is absolutely ridiculous. We use the term cisgender. This is what they say in the document. We use the term, get this, this is really important. We use the term cisgender to refer to someone whose gender is the same as their sex assigned at birth. We acknowledge that some people do not like this term and may even find it offensive. However, we have been unable to find another term that clearly and concisely conveys the same concept. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's Marie. It's woman.
Here's a novel idea.
Man.
here's a novel idea. How about biological male and female? You know, you're telling this paper, I mean, they're actually, parts of it could have actually been quite credible. But when you have this thrown in there, their bias shows right through. Mm. This becomes, you know, you are actually going to call people woman, cisgender, cis woman.
So also knowing, again, who some of the authors and those acknowledged were in this, do you also think, too, that this has been a direct attempt to silence the likes of people who've been working in the gender critical space, like yourself, like Jan Rivers, like the Landy sisters, that have stood up, spoken up, who I know all of you have given repeated submissions in one form or another for various legislations to actually be able to go after you by having this in the Human Rights Act. So they anything. So, for example, I know Roege has been very vocal with the Olympics around what's happened with the boxers. I mean, because there was even a section in there for international, I saw, that potentially they could there was a section in there around international discrimination that they could have a crack at someone like Roe being critical around the IOC allowing these boxers to compete in the Olympics, that there could be a preface there for other people to feel offended on their behalf. It is so murky. It is so murky that all it would do is drag people through a process, tie up resources, create a industrial grievance complex, an industry, and hopefully prevent and shut up and silence people that don't want to go through all the hassle.
Yeah, it might be overwhelming. And this is part of it, isn't it? It's overwhelming. And so people may not want to go through the hassle. But I hope that we have just begun to stir people and to be interested in this, because it's going to happen. Mm. And while we said before that, you know, these submissions, you know, it's like tokenism really, and, you know, virtual signalling, you said, I mean, we need to have everybody submit, but at the end of the day, thousands of submissions, you know, we've seen that they're kind of already going to adopt this. So what else do we need to do, people? What else? I mean, this calls for action. Like, I'm talking physical action. And no, I'm not inciting people to go and storm Parliament. However, this calls for more action than simply writing a submission that we know is going to be piled on top of, you know, thousands of others, especially when you have a panel as such that we've talked about. Yeah, I mean, this is mind-boggling, the whole thing. Like, you know, we can pull out sections of it that need to be discussed. But and I think it would be good, hopefully, that the likes of yourself and other commentators are going to do that over time. But we don't have a lot of time, though. This is the problem. And for something so significant that affects every individual, humanity even, that, you know, you've got this short window to actually read it first, digest some of it. Like you said, it's actually pretty, you know, vomit kind of material to actually digest some of this, to even put into words our feelings, around, you know, how this is going to impact us. So, yeah, I think this is just a beginning, but I would encourage people to talk with others, be listening to the commentary that's happening around this and the importance of it, and maybe even coming together with other like-minded groups, finding ways of how else you can challenge this. Because, yeah, like we said, the submissions are one thing. I mean, you would probably know, and many of your listeners who have put petitions in to government before, we know how that goes. How often do any of these petitions actually achieve a change?
So walk me through the process, because you understand this a little bit better. Walk me through the process. If they'll go through, they'll get submissions, they possibly will hear submissions, but it looks like this is submissions into the Law Commission. What would be then the next steps? I mean, the next steps, in order to change the Human Rights Act, it would then have to be tabled in Parliament as either a private members bill or a select members bill. I can't remember the other one. So what they would then do is they would have to go through that process, wouldn't they? Or would they be able to get their submissions? Because they can't change the act without it passing through Parliament and there being a debate, can they?
No. So this will go to government as the recommendation. They'll have recommendations, supposedly, from, or, you know, after analysing all of our submissions, and then they'll put their recommendation, which we really know what their recommendation already is, right? They've basically said it. So they'll put that to government, and government, yeah, and then the government will, you know, yeah, make a decision on that. Yeah, I mean, it's not looking good, I have to say. When you look at other jurisdictions, other countries, it's not looking good. It's not looking good for us. So that's why I'm suggesting that this is not only about submitting, but coming up with something else where people are going to be very strong. This is going to take the majority of a community to actually stand up and say no.
Mm.
You know, it's going to take all of us. Like, we can, there's a lot of really good organisations out there that are speaking up about this and protecting people in our spaces. But we can't just sit back and think that they're the ones that are going to make the change. It's actually every individual that has to do something about this. We cannot sit down and think this is going to go away. We cannot sit down and think that also that this is a done deal and that we can't do anything about it. One person can do amazing things, and all of us together, we can actually turn this around, I believe.
Mm. And also, too, I do get your point, too, that if you make a submission now, so 5th of September is when these close, that if you make a submission now, there is a possibility that you could stop this at this stage before it goes to the next political stages, which where it will get a little bit more airtime in the sense that people, a little bit more awareness. But if you're able to sort of nix it before it gets there, surely that must help. But the biggest thing really is, I mean, I just scanned through this, I spent an hour scanning through it. It's incredibly wordy. I think they've overcooked it dramatically. I mean, the one entire segment on tikanga and the treaty, which is completely irrelevant. It is designed in such a way as a document, I think, deliberately to deter people to dig into it.
Yeah, you're right. And the issues paper alone, we can critique. Okay, like you said, we can actually critique this first and stop this before it even gets to the next stage by pulling it apart. And I know it's big. So you take a piece that's important to you and you just work on that one. We have to, like, I'm going to be critiquing this whole thing. I mean, it's a shocking paper. It's a shocking issues paper. It's biased. You mentioned, and I've just found it, sorry, I wanted to talk about it before, but I had trouble finding it because it's 200 pages. But you mentioned about the gender critical perspectives, and they have that in here. Now, this is the bias. Again, I show you what they've got. They've got here, as we discussed above, there are a variety of different perspectives on the concepts of sex and gender. Some people are sceptical or cautious. Maria, it's not about being sceptical or cautious. It's reality. Gender critical perspectives, they're saying, are people who are sceptical or cautious about the ideas of gender identity. You know, you see where this is, they've framed this. This issues paper is incredibly framed to have people, you know, this, they are putting words into people's minds, right? They are, what did you say before about re-educate? No. You know,
well, about in terms of creating an entire industrial complex, a grievance industrial complex around re-education of people, because we've already seen this. This already exists. It's already, what they're talking about here in the Law Commission has already moved through things like medicine, for example. So if you are perceived to have broken the guidelines or a code of conduct within your professional body, you then have to go through, and I know people who have done this, who they go through, they call it re-education.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's, and could you imagine by putting this in the Human Rights Act, not only for an employer, but for any individual who then is perceived, and it's again the perception of feelings. I think I saw that in one of the documents, the perception of feelings. So if somebody on the receiving end feels like that their feelings have been hurt by hurty words, or you've looked at them a funny way because they look ridiculous, they then are able to complain about you to the Human Rights Commission. And as I said before, I've been through the process. I've got the freaking T-shirt, and it's probably nowhere near as benign as it was when I went through it more than a decade ago to going through it now. What the impact that can have on you, your professional life and your other relationships and the stigma. To me, all of this is by a highly motivated activist group getting something added into an act where by their own, you know, they could be protected anyway, but they're wanting to do it and specify it so they can put a virtue signalling stake in the ground to literally shut everybody up.
Yeah, it's to shut everybody up and to recreate a society to their agenda and their views, which in my opinion, and this is another topic of conversation, is largely based on mental disorders. And we'll go there another time.
Yeah.
But look, one of the things I've just found is these are the countries that have adopted this, and there's a few of them, with these law cases. So this is what happens, and this is why I say, you know, it's not just the re-education, it's actually completely tipping society upside down. So one of the outcomes of a lawsuit for a restaurant, they had to update their policies to use non-binary gender neutral language throughout the whole company. So this would mean, and this is the courts actually saying, telling them to do this. For example, they say replacing references to men or women with people and replacing his, her, she's and hers with they, them. This is not just about being kind or inclusive. This is completely tipping society upside down. You know, this is a court saying to remove men and women terms. This is a court saying remove his, hers and replace it. So this is huge. I mean, you know, I'm sure people are hearing this, the urgency and the importance of what this is actually doing to or going to do to society. We've seen it. We can already see it happening.
And it's creating to a self-fulfilling cycle, isn't it? Because already in the document you read before that they claimed in terms of discrimination within the workplace that that is experienced more by those within this community, but by them being in the community and being how they are, as I said to you before, like if I were an employer and say for a generic business and I had a whole heap of CVs come in, and anybody who has gone through dozens and dozens of CVs, you all do this. There'll be certain things that you look at that you will go, because you don't have time to interview everybody, right? So you'll be looking for key skills. You'll be looking for different things. Also, I mean, not that I've ever done this, but I have to admit, if a CV came through and they them pronouns, bin, straight away, I wouldn't even consider it, bin, gone, see ya. So then what you're doing is by being somebody in that space or representing yourself or clearly virtue signaling of who it is they are because they can't help themselves because they're all narcissists and they have to do that. Then if I'm an employer on the other side of that and I see that, I'd be taking one look at that and all I'd be seeing is dollar signs lawsuits, pain in the ass. I'm not going to employ you. So what then happens? Oh, but those who are in the intersectional or rainbow or transgender community are more grossly affected by unemployment figures. Yeah, because you're freaking unemployable and you make yourself unemployable. And all this will do is make them even more unemployable.
100% spot on there. How far do we want to take this, Marie? So one of the debates that I participated up in Auckland, there were three furries in the audience. What are you going to do, Marie, when a furry, for people in the audience who don't know what a furry is, it is human people, males or females, who wear cat ears and identify as cats. What pronoun and gender identity do they use, Marie? If someone has a gender identity as a furry, what are you going to say to them as an employer? I mean, seriously. I mean, what are people thinking? This is, it's a great way to finish on how ridiculous this is around, you know, the mental health of people. This is what we're putting into law, mental health issues in law. Because you're going to tell me that by saying that people that are walking around with cat ears, that I'm discriminating against their human rights as a cat. To identify as a cat. Where have we got to? This is absolutely mind-boggling, but it's serious stuff that we've got it now being pushed through law.
And also too, I've said to you many times before, this is an ideology of affluence. And the fact that, you know, times have been so good that they've been able to entertain such acts of ridiculousness and whimsy. Sometimes, too, I wonder whether the difficulty, financial difficulties, which people are being squeezed, businesses are being squeezed, the unemployment rate is being squeezed. The reality of it is by codifying something like this in law, all you're doing is exacerbating a problem in order to placate a virtue. And this sort of stuff has just got to stop. So this document, so I'm going to make sure for everybody in the show notes, if you go to the show notes for this once the replay has popped up, there will be a link so you can download this document and have a look at it for yourself. And Helen, I think your advice as well, because It is a chunky document, is scan through. There is a table of contents, which is what I did. So I went to the bits that I was interested in. Have a look at the table of contents. And I think, Helen, your advice is spot on. Find that one thing that you're particularly invested in. So if you're an employer, look at the employment stuff. If you're somebody in the gender critical space, look at that. I mean, there's multiple different places that you can look. Pick that one thing and actually, as you said, apply a argument and a submission based on that. I think that that is a really good piece of advice, because it then makes it a lot less overwhelming for people. And what was that date again, Helen, for those submissions, if you want to pop something in?
The date is the 5th of September, so we don't have long. It's really important to look at that. And there are groups, as I said, who I know of one, is it Free Speech Union? I'm pretty sure that they might have mentioned it recently, and I think they've even got a website where, so this is another point actually, for people that find this kind of thing quite challenging to navigate, because it is, I mean, it's a document that even you and I are struggling with, and it creates a lot of angst. So for people who really might struggle even more so with this, there's Free Speech Union, go and find them, and I think they're putting together a website where people can actually submit through. They've already created, well, they're creating some documents where people can use their document to submit. So that would be my suggestion. But I really appreciate you having this conversation with me today. We need everybody to be aware of what is happening around this, around the gender identity and its legal recognition. So thank you, Marie.
Oh, you're most welcome. They never sleep, Helen. They never sleep. And I'm sure there'll be more for us to talk about, as there always is in the future. And we will keep an eye on this, because, as you said, I do have a sinking feeling that it could be a foregone conclusion, but that's okay, because it then has to get to the parliamentary level. And, you know, the fight continues and the information continues, and we can continue having this discussion. So this is Helen Houghton, leader of the new Conservative Party. If you've got anything that you would like to share with Helen or I, inbox at realitycheck.radio is the email, 2057 is the text.
Fantastic.
So there's more ways to continue this discussion. And Helen, as always, I appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks, Marie.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.